And welcome to the School of Law podcast. My name is Anne Lynch, and I'm a PhD student in the School of Law. I also work as a lecturer in MTU, the Munster Technological University, as a law lecturer. My PhD is in an area concerning law and healthcare, and it's about decision making in healthcare for adults with severe to profound intellectual disabilities. And really, I suppose my PhD is about finding out how that happens. There is a huge chunk of it that involves empirical work, which I have completed. And for me, anyway, that's the part that makes it so interesting. Talking to people, finding out what actually happens on the ground and where that sits with the law. I always talk about my PhD in the context of where it came from. And I suppose my background is in practice. I worked as a solicitor for many years and used to, I suppose, telling people what the law is and informing them what the law is and the parameters around their situation. But I found myself doing some part-time lecturing to nurses in the School of Nursing in UCC and confronted by students who were doing their placements telling me, actually, consent capacity doesn't operate like that on the ground. We have a different story to tell. And that's really, I suppose, what piqued my interest in this. And I really felt confronted by the difference of what I understood to be consent and capacity and what was happening on the ground, and hence my journey into a very interesting PhD. And this brings me to our interview today, talking with one of my supervisors, Professor Mary Donnelly in the School of Law. Mary, along with Dr. Claire Murray, they are my joint supervisors and excellent asset for enduring with me on this journey, but a very interesting journey. So today in this latest episode in the series showcasing the impact made by the School of Law faculty members across Ireland and the world, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Mary Donnelly. Mary. And Mary has engaged in prolific academic research in the area of health and capacity law. And she has published widely in this field in Ireland and internationally, and has a growing public service role, quite prolific, which involves an awful lot of work. And this is what Mary is going to talk with me about today. So, hi, Mary, how are you? So I suppose maybe just looking at this public service work, if you could perhaps provide us with a description of the work that you're involved in relation to health and capacity law.
Thanks a million, Anne. And that was a great description of your thesis, which is a really valuable piece of work. Really looking forward to that being finished and getting it out there into the world.
You and me both.
So huge amounts of the kind of thing I do, in a sense, really speaks to the kind of work you're doing, the public service work I do. It is growing, and one of the reasons I think it's growing is because we're more and more aware of this space that you describe really well there, which is this dissonance between law having a particular sort of nice, neat story to tell, and the much, much more complex story of how things actually operate on the ground. Yeah. And a lot of my public service work is really about that on the ground stuff. So very much links, I think, in a way to your academic research, as it were, a lot of my public service stuff. So in terms of the different roles I play, I have a kind of fairly extensive HSE role. I'm a joint chair of the National Consent Policy Advisory Group, And I'm also joint chair of the Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act Commencement Group. And in both cases, I work with the Human Rights and Equality Unit in the HSE. And my joint chair, my partner in crime, is Professor Sean O'Keefe in NUIG, who's a geriatrician from NUIG. So that's one side of the work. And I suppose part of that in more recent times, as well as those two committees, we've also, Sean and myself and various other people, have been on the vaccination consent working group, the HSE vaccination consent working group. And that's been really busy since.
A very interesting.
That's been really interesting. And that's been since January. So we've been kind of, when things were really hot in the beginning, when we were really trying to figure out some of the consent issues, we were every week. And now we're kind of every week to 2 weeks, depending on. And we're trying to respond because, as you know, the vaccination program changes and shifts, and who gets vaccinated and how changes and shifts. So consent issues are really big in that context. So that's
it's interesting, though, to think that the HSE, I'm sure, has progressed in its thinking, in that they even thought to have a consent committee for the vaccination program that I'm sure in years gone by that wouldn't even have been a consideration.
That's a really good insight, Anne, and until you said it, I don't think I quite realized it, and you're absolutely right. There are various reasons for that. You're absolutely right, and the fact that there was a consent working group put in place very early on. And of course, one of the reasons for that was the first cohort of people, if you look, remember back to January, the first cohort of people to be vaccinated were the over 85s in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And so for a considerable group of those people, there were capacity issues. You know, obviously not for everyone, but you had people who had capacity issues. So the question which was how should consent be done where a person doesn't have the capacity of themselves to consent? And there was a statutory instrument introduced which prioritised the will and preference of the person. I made it very, very clear. This isn't a family decision. This is the person's decision. This is person's will and preference and their benefit. And of course, for people in nursing homes at that stage, it was very much, unless they were in the very end of their lives, there was an issue around frail older people, you know, frail people who were within maybe within a month or so of the end of their lives. For them, really, it wasn't. But for most people, it was very clearly because the virus was at that stage running rampant through the nursing homes. Now, obviously, the risk-benefit analysis then changes as you go through the different cohorts. Mm. Like at the moment, we're working on consent for, in terms of locating this, consent around, as people may know, we've got this issue, which is that younger people can choose whether to go for an AstraZeneca vaccine or to wait, or Janssen, or wait for a Pfizer if they choose. That's a very different risk benefit balance. So that's been a huge part of that work. And yeah, it was really interesting. It is really interesting. And what's been really striking is how few problems they've been. How people have really bought into the consent process, and that's been really good.
Perhaps similar to some of my finding is that you need it there, you know, and the committee and the thinking through and consequences and maybe unforeseen consequences, but you know, pandemic thinking, it's probably the access to vaccination. This allows me to do this, perhaps. It's not as consent isn't as big an issue for people on the ground.
You're so right. I mean, that's absolutely true. Access was the big issue. And of course, that's one of the big findings out of your thesis, which is very often it's all about access to care rather than an obsession with consent. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Anyhow, coming back to the other things I do, I'm also recently started on the National Research Ethics Committee, and that's very interesting. Ireland has established, we had a COVID-19 NREC which was the first national ethics committee that was established back in 2020 in March. And I was a member of that. And now we've kind of moved on to a more general national research ethics committee. So I'm a member of that. And that's really interesting. And then in terms of other things, I'm a member of it, and I'm actually the deputy chair of one of the committees as well. And then I also do work with the Mental Health Commission, their legislation committee. So one of the things we do there is any legislation relating to mental health, we work through it and make recommendations to the Mental Health Commission. And then finally, I have got myself involved with a lot of really interesting work going on around screening. Because as you know, the whole sort of survival screening issues, the way in which we do screening, consent to screening, and all that goes with that. So we've got three screening programs. We've got four screening programs in Ireland. We've got cervical screening, we've got breast screening, we've got bowel screening, we've got retinal screening. So issues around, again, consent and all to do with that. And also information, ensuring people have accurate information. So that, I think, is all off them.
A comprehensive. I don't know how you do it all.
That's the challenge, is to do it, because you have to do it right. Obviously, if you're doing this, you have to come and do it right. So it's, even those, and of course, they're not always all at full steam.
Yes,
all the time. You know what I mean? That sounds there like as if you're constantly. Whereas, of course, you know, different things will be at full steam at different times.
And what I suppose, could you give us an example of what it might involve? Maybe in picking one of them, what it might involve in terms of your input?
Well, I'll just talk briefly about the HSE stuff. So the consent policies, we've had a consent policy, and that actually, because consent policy and the assisted decision making, that stuff, those issues work best with say your work. So you described it really well. You know, you described this dissonance between this sort of law, which is in cases and books, and actually people's experience on the ground. And one of the things, and I know you know this from all of your interviews, and I know this from all of the people I talk to, which is that the law and the legal requirements and actually how people need to behave and what they need to do on the ground, this dissonance is really difficult for people. People who really want to get it right. But it's very, very difficult. And sometimes it's the patients who suffer in those kinds of situations. And there's a tremendous amount of grey area in Irish health law, as you know. There's just so much that is grey. There's so much, you know, you can say certain things, but you know, we're still, in terms of grey areas, the issue we talked about, which was consent. You can't give consent for someone once they're over 18. Nobody else can consent on their behalf unless authorized by the court, and that's just rare, except kind of situations. What is the legal position there? Well, the short answer is we don't know. It sounds bizarre that this is such a phenomenally important thing, but we don't know. 16-year-olds and consent to medical treatment. We all operate at this stage on the basis that a 16-year-old can, but there is still a certain amount of grayness around the edges of that. Now, there are two really basic things which are left very, very gray, and then layers more gray.
So difficult then for a healthcare professional in practice who's the actual person interacting with... the person who needs the healthcare, trying to decide, and you can't give a black and white answer. So part of their training, of course, is managing risk.
Yeah.
That dirty word, but they have to do that as well, and it's so, so difficult. So doing this kind of work in terms of policy, it's hugely beneficial, I think, for people on the ground.
That's the aim, is to try to. So what we do with, we'd say, the national consent policy is we try to clarify where the law, you know, is clear. So we state where the law is clear. And then otherwise, and obviously it's not just me and the chair, my co-chair, but we have, you know, We work with a steering group, we work with an implementation group, we work with all sorts of groups. We take a very wide number of stakeholder perspectives, and then we offer guidance, which is the best we can do in a circumstance where the law isn't clear. So that takes a lot of time. And that's been a really, as in to get to a point where the guidance you are offering is as legally accurate as it can be. Obviously, that's mm-hmm. the fundamental. But which also takes account of a whole variety of stakeholder perspectives. But the aim is something which talks to people on the ground, which makes their lives easier. And that's, I suppose, what we've been, now with the consent policy, we've been working on it, well, on a revise. We've got a consent policy in place. My colleague, I was involved in the development of the original one back in 2013. And my colleague, Deirdre Madden, was the chair yes. of that process yes. and did a smashing job on it. And now we're revising it to take account of all sorts of changes. We'd hoped to be ready to go early-ish 2020. And then, of yeah. course, COVID. So obviously the HSE took a real battering, or has been taking a real battering. Mm-hmm. But we're still hoping that by the end of this summer, we will have this out. We're nearly there. And then we will be turning our attention to the commencement of the Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act, which I know is very close to your heart.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. 2015, the date of the act, and it's great to think that
it's finally
going to happen, you know.
So it is,
but just one thing just there that, you know, when we talk about just kind of something I'm interested in the, you know, we talk about the dissonance between the legal framework and the fantastic work in terms of the national consent policy. And it is, you know, I mean, I have in my empirical work heard so many people talk about it and use it, which is great. But on the other side, in terms of the law, the lawyers, the courts, the judges, you know, I wonder sometimes, how do we move that cohort along to meet the healthcare practitioners? Because as we've talked as well, that, you know, what one of the findings in my work is that in practice, we see how progressed in healthcare in their practice they are, whether it's supporting people with impaired capacity, respecting their autonomy. And, you know, there are instances along the way that show otherwise as well. But it is very positive. But I wonder, you know, I suppose maybe as well, having come from practice and seeing that, you know, you tell people what the law is, that it's not, and sometimes some of the judgments that you see maybe aren't as enlightened as you'd like them to be.
That's a really good question, Anne, and you're absolutely right. And I mean, I suppose like you, I was in practice, so we have that that instinct, and we both know that your instinct as a solicitor is risk avoidance. You know, avoid being sued, whatever you do, and taking account of what you might describe as the human elements. You know, the cost. Like I remember a story which in a book which I'm involved in editing, but it's a story about a man who it's written by, I think it was a speech and language therapist. And, you know, we this particular book, which is going to be marvelous, has loads of people on the ground talking about their experience. But this man, he would be severe, profound disabilities, loved his cup of coffee. He just loved a cup of coffee. Mm. And somebody decided, for risk reasons, that it was too risky, it was a choke risk. So his cup of coffee was then, and you're familiar with that thickener thing which people put into things. So his cup of coffee became a cup of sludge, essentially. And he started acting out. He was distressed, he was more aggressive, he was all sorts of things. And you can see how somebody somewhere made a risk decision. There's a risk, but didn't take account of all the other risks.
Yes.
So now eventually, and this is a sign of the progress you've been talking about on the ground, people on the ground said, this isn't working. We need to we need to take this risk. We need to recognize that for this man's well-being, his will and preference is his cup of coffee.
Yeah.
But lawyers are devils, and we both know it because we've both done it for risk-based, a certain kind of risk. So, yes, there's a huge need for education.
Yeah.
The current president of the High Court, so the president of the High Court is huge in these situations because his or her, they determine the list. Typically, President Peter Kelly pretty much took all of these cases, so he had a huge impact. The current president takes many of them, but there are also a number of war chief judges as well now. So that's kind of, I think, better in the sense of spreading the issue around. But certainly she is showing a very strong awareness of these issues. So there is some movement, but you're absolutely right. The law is not always the friend to progress here.
Yes.
And that's something which is well worth remembering.
It's a nice way of putting it. It is. And it's there is movement. It takes time. And it takes narratives, it takes work, it takes sociolegal work.
Yeah.
Probably takes a few cases as well. To go through the courts.
I think so. But that's why work like you're doing, which is really grounded work, which is really actually talking to people on the ground. And there are other people doing other kinds of work in this sphere as well. But that's incredibly valuable, which is sort of making sure that the voice is heard. And that point, coming back, I know we've talked about it a bit, risk, and coming back to thinking about how we understand risk. And unless we can broaden that understanding, we will be stuck without progress. So that's why work like you're doing is a great
Mary.
Great addition.
Thanks, Mary. Well, I do think I remember being at a conference once and asking a question about risk and being very seen as a very negative thing. And it's not that, of course, that the conversation should be about risk, but you have to talk about it, because in real life it's, and in fairness for those, whether it is a medical practitioner, whether it is a lawyer, whether it is a healthcare assistant, you know, you are in the situation, and I think you need to, maybe you're not going to have the security of always going, is this exactly right? But you have to, there has to be a discussion around it. And I think policy has to take that into account as well.
I completely agree. And I think one of the things which we try to do with, let's say, the national consent policy, or, you know, the work that we'll be doing on, And by the way, just to say that the HSE has been working since 2016, as you know, I'm trying to get us ready for for the act to commence, so that it's not just that we're starting now, but we're really seeing a ramp up now. But part of the way of trying to address risk is like by setting out kind of clear policies and guidelines. It's a good way of addressing risk, because of minimizing risk, or at least giving people a certain degree of protection. They follow the guidelines. Their individual responsibility is, you know, they're not having to hold and carry all the responsibility themselves. And I think that's why these kinds of steps are really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just even in your other work in terms of ethics, and that you see it, you know, I see it in some of the lecturing I do in employment law, that these ethical guidelines are, because whether it's in the area of cybercrime, whether it's in employment law, it's all now about codes of ethics.
Absolutely.
And the law just can't keep up with it. But what you're seeing in some of the, particularly in the employment law cases, is references to ethical guidelines. So you didn't break the law, but, you know, you didn't adhere to the guidelines. And that's seems to be viewed negatively then by the courts.
Yeah. And we're seeing that an awful lot more. So, for example, we'd say in our area, you do see the consent policy being referenced by the courts and by counsel before the courts. It has no legal status as such, but it is taken. And similarly, you see the medical counsel ethics guidance being referenced by the courts. So it's this weird place, and it's a growing space. It's a place where, I suppose, academics play an increasing role, which is this space of policy, of guidelines, of codes. And it's it's a word when we were, I'm older than you, but we'd say looking back to when we were sort of starting out, there was the law and that was pretty much it. I mean, you know, there was very little, but this kind of regulatory space has really grown and is continuing to grow. And that, of course, is a space where I guess academics tend to be very useful in feeding into.
Because I was just going to ask you then, what motivates you to be involved in the area of public service roles?
Question. I suppose in the first instance, I really do believe that academics have a role to play. I really believe that, I believe we have a duty if we can contribute, but I also believe we have a role to play. I think we were much slower in Ireland at recognising the contribution which academics can make. Other countries were way ahead of us and we're catching up now. The world is a very complex place. Again, if you think we'd say back to even 20 years ago, you know, this substratum of kind of regulation, of codes, of policy, of informed political decision making, it's a really complex, and as you very correctly said, Anne, it's really fast moving. I mean, legislation just couldn't keep up. It literally couldn't. And of course, the problem with legislation very often is it's very difficult to change. It's very unresponsive. Getting dwell time is so difficult. So that space is a really important space. And I think academics have a big role to play there. The other thing is, I suppose, the people I work with are brilliant, which is really nice. I don't think I'd do this if people weren't brilliant.
Interesting. It's back to, isn't it, like positive relationships really, you know, helps an area to thrive?
Oh, completely. You have to trust the people you're working with.
Yes.
You know, there has to be really, you know, and I've been working now with Sean as joint chair, and also with the human rights unit. We'd say that HSE work since, oh gosh, 2013 or so. So they're quite old relationships at this stage. And obviously I'm developing new relationships and some of the newer things, but it's hugely important. I mean, you're so right. And this is a finding from your work too, which is relationships are absolutely crucial. And then I suppose I learn a huge amount. You know, I learn enormous amounts. Like I would certainly say that I'm the net beneficiary of this kind of stuff. My only problem really is time. If I had more time.
But well, this is what I was going to say to you. Like you have to have the space for this, you know. And certainly, what I've learned is that, you know, the space in thinking and how you need it. It's actually not filling your time with more things. It's actually trying to distill work and trying to, understand what it's telling you. Really does take a massive amount of time and space. So for that high level input that you're bringing to public service really does take a lot of time, space, effort.
But collaboration, I mean, we'd say I learn a huge amount from supervising your thesis. You know, I get a huge, you know, as an example, because you get a huge flavor of, okay, this is what people are saying on the ground, you know, and then I get similar people, you know, so that idea of collaboration and working with people, I think is hugely important. You really do produce things from working with people that you could never.
Yeah.
I think, and I'm sure if you're an incredibly clever philosopher, you can produce incredibly clever, for example, theoretical work. But this kind of stuff, you actually need different inputs. You can't do it with just your own perspective.
No.
You need other people's as well.
No, you can't. And it's interesting that you have those coming at you from different angles as well. Just one last question for you, Mary. Any advice for early career academics in getting involved in public service work? Or
it's a great thing to do. So that's the first thing. It's a really good thing to do. Build up slowly.
Yeah.
Make contacts. Don't take on too much too soon. This is really rich coming from me, but you know, get yourself in. I think it's enormously beneficial. So, look. So, for example, there is for certainly some bodies, you can make an application. We'd say I'm just thinking of CORU or the Medical Council. There was an application process to get involved in some of their committees. So think about what you want to get involved with and then look for ways to do it. But start small, build up, learn. There's a lot of learning, how to deal with people. You know, so start small, but definitely something I would recommend. You know, so start small. Look at the places that you think that you could make a contribution, but also that you'd gain from. I mean, yes. This is a, you know, this is a kind of a, I guess, a symbiotic thing in the sense that you do gain from this. This isn't all just about you giving. You are learning. So think about where you can learn best, but also where you can make your best contribution.
That's great advice. Mary, thank you very much and for doing this interview. It's been illuminating for me and hopefully for those listening. So if you'd like to hear more School of Law podcast episodes, including further interviews in this current series, then you can subscribe to our channel via any podcast provider. So thanks again, Mary. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne.